Welcome to the Gay Buddhist Forum, where teachers from all schools of Buddhism offer their perspectives on the Dharma and its application in modern times, especially for LGBTQI audiences. These talks are offered freely to the world and made possible by appreciative listeners. If you would like to support our efforts to share the Dharma with underserved audiences, please visit gaybuddhist.org. There you can donate, find a list of upcoming speakers, or enjoy many hundreds of these recorded talks dating back to 1996.
At this time, just before we hear from our Dharma speaker, it's our custom to go around the room and introduce ourselves to one another. I'm Martin Snow.
Peter.
Douglas.
Tom Bruin.
I'm Carl Wolf.
Rich Aronow.
Baruch Golden.
Cass Braden.
Jin Yar.
Craig.
Anthony.
Jim.
Gary.
Leon.
Bill.
Nuhu.
Chris.
Jay.
Mark Olson.
Larry Wish.
Arthur Pena.
Dennis Maylith.
Marty.
Rule.
Daniel.
Guy.
Peter Dell.
Tim.
David.
Michael Murphy.
Charlie.
Todd.
Darren.
Jim Stewart.
Mark.
Lisa.
George.
Daniel.
Jeff.
Ari Fleming.
Ray Dyer.
Robert.
Joe Good.
Bill Childs.
Richard Azzolini.
Rudolfo Carvajal.
Paul Shepard,
Michael,
Scott Davis,
Richard,
Lee Robbins,
Elliot,
Will Murdoch,
Peter,
Sue,
and our Dharma speakers. Is anyone here for the first or second time or returning after a long absence? Yes, and your name again?
Elliot.
Elliot, welcome, Elliot.
I'm Rudolfo.
Rudolfo, welcome.
Charlie.
Charlie, welcome. And
Craig.
Another one? There. Oh, yes. Thank you. Okay. Welcome, all of you. During the social half hour after our Dharma talk, longer-term members would like to extend a hand of welcome to you. So please mix with people and ask any questions you might have. We're glad you're here. Okay, with that, I want to introduce Susan Moon, our speaker this morning. She's been with us before, and we've always enjoyed her Dharma talks. Susan is a writer, teacher, and until recently editor of Turning Wheel magazine. She is the author of The Life and Letters of Tofu Roshi, a humor book about an imaginary Zen master, and she's editor of Not Turning Away, The Practice of Engaged Buddhism. Her short stories and personal essays have been published widely. She has been a Zen student since 1976 and is now with Norman Fisher's Everyday Zen Sangha, where she has received lay entrustment, a lay version of the Dharma transmission from Norman Fisher. She's the mother of two grown sons, too. With that, Susan, I'd like to turn it over to you.
Thank you, Marvin. It's very nice to be here again. I really appreciate this Sangha and the wonderful welcoming spirit you have and the spirit of community. It's great to be here again. I wanted to tell you what happened to me on the way over here before I take up my topic for the day, because it was really intense. I was driving over the Bay Bridge, and as I came through the toll gates, you know how the lanes kind of merge into fewer lanes, and I merged, and I kind of cut in front of somebody who was merging into the same lane as me, I guess. I didn't really realize it, and I didn't realize that this car was close to me. And I didn't put my turn signal on. I wasn't really changing lanes. But anyway, all of a sudden there was a loud honk behind me, and this person was obviously mad. And then a moment later, he pulled up beside me on the lane next to me on the right and started screaming at the top of his lungs, You slammed my dogs into the fucking windshield! Pull over, pull over, pull over! And he was really enraged. And I thought, boy, this is what you call road rage. And he just kept driving up on either side of me and going with his finger, pull over, pull over! And I just kept going. I didn't really want to pull over and have a conversation. I'm really sorry. I kept mouthing. And then he'd pull over on the other side and kind of be right next to me, and then pull over on the other side and be right next to me and keep pointing to the side of the road, pull over, and tailgating me. And then he went around, and I just sort of kept going. Just keep calm, just keep going. And he went in front of me, and he went slower and slower and slower in front of me until we were at came to a complete stop in the middle of the big bridge. And cars were whizzing by, and I thought, well, I'm just not gonna play this game. And so some other cars stopped behind me, and they pulled around, and then I just sort of pulled around like I was another car and just kept driving. So what could he do, actually? I mean, he's enraged, but he's putting himself at risk if he's really going to try and run me off the road. But so, and then as we approached Yerba Buena Island, he started in again, get off at the exit, get off at the exit! And I just kept driving. And I thought it was really good opportunity for practice. I was really... And I thought, is he going to follow me all the way to the Gay Buddhist Fellowship meeting? And I'll get the guys to come out and protect me. And so I just kept breathing and kept going, and he stayed right behind me, and I figured, you know, time is on my side. He probably, you know, he'll calm down. He just can't sustain this anger forever, and maybe the bridge will be long enough that he'll calm down. And then I actually started to try to sincerely, not in a fake way, sort of send him loving kindness. I think this man must really be suffering. And the people around him in his life are probably suffering, and his dogs might even be suffering. And I hope he can calm down, and I hope he doesn't feel that he has to spend his entire Sunday morning chasing some woman around San Francisco to beat her up. You know, that would be a waste of his time. So somehow, when we finally came across the bridge, he suddenly pulled out from behind me and just zipped off at the first exit by Fremont Street there, or whatever it is. And I raised a big sigh of relief. So that was my recent practice opportunity. But I did, and I was trying to think, well, what is the lesson here? And I think, I mean, my heart is still kind of beating from it, because I was genuinely frightened, because you read about the crazy things people do on the highway when they're incensed, and cars are lethal weapons. So anyway, I just thought, yeah, just keep, try to keep calm and extend your circle of calm outwards. So anyway, here I am.
is there anything we can do to help you release it?
I think just telling you the story really helped. I mean, that's one reason I wanted to share it with you and to sort of remind myself that all is well, and I'm grateful for the precious opportunity of human birth. And really, I do think that just keeping calm and following your breath helps. And I was actually consciously following my breathing, too, as I was driving, and vowing to be really careful about merging and looking in the rearview mirror and signaling to a fault. I don't know if the title of my talk went out, but anyway, my subject today is getting old. And I want to start by telling you the story that you probably all know about how Shakyamuni Buddha, when he grew up in the palace, he was totally protected by his father from all signs of suffering in the world. His father, the king, wanted him to just have a happy life free from sorrow. But when he was a young man, he went out of the walls of the palace with in a carriage from the palace with a companion or a carriage driver, and perhaps his father decided that he was old enough to go see a little bit more of the kingdom, to understand more what his responsibilities would be when he became king, which is what his father wanted him to do. And anyway, he saw that day for the first time an old person, a sick person, and a dead person, and he had never seen such a thing in his life. And he said to his companion, "What is the matter with these people?" And one wonders how his father managed to keep the old, the sick, and the dead from his view all that time inside the palace compound. Dead, yes, you can bury dead people pretty quickly. I guess you can put sick people in an infirmary pretty quickly. But old people, you wonder, well, didn't he have any old tutors or any old great aunts or uncles or anything? But anyway, that's not in the story. I guess he didn't. this old man was bent with age, and I imagine his companion saying to him, "Well, yes, this person is suffering old age because he's been around for a long time, and he's bent with age, and he has osteoarthritis in his knees, and he has a sore hip, and he can't digest very well, and he probably doesn't remember what village he even lives in." These three people were the first three of the four heavenly messengers, they were called. And then after he saw them, Buddha saw, Shakyamuni saw a monk by the side of the road walking along with his begging bowl, and he asked, "Who is that man?" And his companion said, "Well, he's a spiritual practitioner, and he's given up the ways of the world and let go of riches, and he lives in the forest, and he's seeking the truth." And so all four of these people were the four heavenly messengers, because they came into Shakyamuni's consciousness to remind him that this life is impermanent, and that our purpose can be to awaken our hearts and focus on what is most important, and that all of us will experience old age, sickness, and we won't all necessarily experience old age, but if we live long enough, we will, and we certainly will all experience some form of illness in our lives, and we will all die. So this was a great teaching for Shakyamuni. And I used to wonder long ago why old age was included in these three terrible sufferings, but now I'm beginning to find out. And I find it affirming that in the teaching story it is considered one of the forms of suffering that Shakyamuni saw, because then it makes me feel less of a sissy when I think sometimes that it's hard. But I'm not. I have a lot more hard stuff to come, I realize. But anyway, we all have the opportunity to learn from these heavenly messengers. And as far as age goes, we're not all old, but we're all moving in the same direction. We're all going that way. And we're all actually aging at the same rate, even though we might be at a different place along the timeline. And we all know people who are old in our lives. And there's different... old age does have a way of receding as you approach it. You know, you think people are old. They get... what you think is old gets older and older and older. But still, I think the point comes when you actually seat yourself on the old side of the line. And I learned that gerontologists make the distinction between the young old and the old old, which is kind of interesting. And it's not a distinction in years. It's that people who are old in years can be young old when they're still able to live their lives in a similar fashion that they have been, and they're not seriously disabled or unable to continue their fields of activity, and they're independent. And then when people become really infirm or disabled or frail and have losses that require much more help and more limitations on their life, they become part of the old old. So there's a kind of different... And of course, it's not a sharp division either. That, too, is a gradual continuum, but they're different aspects of aging. And I have been thinking about it myself. And old age is really, a lot of it is about loss. Aging is about loss and loss of a number of different abilities and faculties. And loss is actually, every loss is a gate. I'm learning to think about that, that each time we lose something, and this doesn't apply just to the losses of age, it applies to any loss, the loss of a loved one, or the loss of a job, or whatever, there's also a gate there where you walk through into, okay, what's on the other side of this loss, and what am I waking up to now? So I think we can bring that awareness to the losses of aging as well. Some of the particular things that I would describe as the challenges of aging are, there's the cosmetic losses in a society where youth is so highly valued, which is perhaps one of the most superficial losses, but still it makes a difference to some people more than others, but you have a tendency to become kind of invisible. And I've noticed actually, I think probably, I don't know if women and men experience this particular thing differently, but anyway, just having gray hair is a sort of subliminal signal that is like a curtain coming down or something. And I've noticed sometimes I dye my hair red on occasion, and I notice that I am actually less invisible. People say hello to me more in the post office or something like that. I mean, it was kind of I was surprised by how much of a difference it made last year when, just for the heck of it, I dyed my hair kind of a bright red. So there is something real that's different there. But then, more significantly, there's real discomfort. There's physical discomfort that can come from aging, and I don't need to tell you what they are. I myself do have a lot of arthritis in my knees, and last time I was here, I was sitting on the floor, and now I'm sitting in a chair, and I can't do the kind of strenuous hiking that I used to really enjoy, so that's a loss. And then, more frighteningly, there is also loss of mental abilities that we're used to thinking of ourselves as having, and you know, it's kind of a litany. People complain to each other as they get older about losing their memory, and lots of jokes about not remembering people's names and things. But it can be frightening, and it can be more or less extreme. And I am certainly experiencing that too. I notice myself doing things like, for example, I don't trust myself anymore. I don't trust myself to remember to do things. So I don't trust that I remembered to turn off my cell phone, so I just turn it on instead, or I pay a bill twice, or I can't remember where I parked the car, or things like that. So those are all things that we can find ways to work with and try to approach with some curiosity and kind of challenge of okay, how am I going to work with this, and what is this helping me to understand about human life, and how can I just enjoy the fact that I really am more in the present now, so that I can't remember what happened 5 minutes ago. I'm here right now, and if I tell my friends the same story over and over again, I'm hoping that their memory is as bad as mine and they're hearing it freshly as if for the first time. I think approaching it also with humor and lightness is a very significant tool. It's not a trivial thing to apply humor to this situation and not to take ourselves so seriously. Actually, I wanted to read you this speech that I know will be familiar to many of you from Shakespeare, from As You Like It. It's about the seven ages of man. And I love it because it helps put a perspective on old age as just part of the impermanence of life. All these different stages are impermanent, and they each have their difficulties. And in this speech, each of the seven ages is kind of made fun of and shown to have its own problems. So, and it's very, you know, it's Shakespearean language. But anyway, it goes, "All the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players. They have their exits and their entrances. And one man in his time plays many parts, his acts being seven ages. At first, the infant, mewling and puking in the nurse's arms. Then the whining schoolboy with his satchel and shining morning face, creeping like snail unwillingly to school. And then the lover, sighing like furnace, with a woeful ballad made to his mistress' eyebrow. Then a soldier, full of strange oaths and bearded like the leopard, jealous in honor, sudden and quick in quarrel, seeking the bubble reputation even in the cannon's mouth." I think that man driving the truck today in that stage of his life. "And then the justice in fair round belly with good capon lined, with eyes severe and beard of formal cut, full of wise saws and modern instances, and so he plays his part. The sixth age shifts into the lean and slippered pantaloon with spectacles on nose and pouch on side, his youthful hose well saved, a world too wide for his shrunk shank, and his big manly voice turning again toward childish treble, pipes and whistles in his sound. Last scene of all that ends this strange, eventful history is second childishness and mere oblivion, sans teeth, sans eyes, sans taste, sans everything." So we all do it. We all get to go through this. As far as we get along the path, we go through these stages. And all of them have their attendant problems, and old age is just one more impermanent stage. And so it kind of goes very well, I think, with the Buddhist teaching of no fixed self, that you can't really cling to who you are at one moment because that's going to change. So I wanted to speak especially about some of the things I've experienced in connection with retiring from my job editing Turning Wheel, which I did last summer. And I chose to retire, and I was really looking forward to it because I want to spend more time teaching and writing in particular. And I've done that, and I do not regret having retired from that job at all. But it has been much, much more challenging than I expected, and I was kind of shocked to discover how attached I was to having this identity and this community and this sense of structure in my life. And now I've had to let go of that, and I have to kind of make it up afresh as I go along in a way, and I have to decide what to do first when I get up in the morning, and I have to create my own structure and sense of purpose. And I'm busy with lots of projects that I care about and that are meaningful, but it's not the same as having this sort of handy label that feels purposeful. And I didn't really expect that. I thought, you know, it was humbling to see that this is something I'm dealing with. So that, again, is a really strong teaching about not being too attached to these identities, because they do change. And how is this gate that I've gone through in retiring from that job, how is this a gate and a new opportunity for me? And so I am experiencing it as a time to get to ask afresh really the question about, you know, who am I actually, and what is actually going on right now, and to wake up intensely in this moment. Because if you keep doing the same thing year after year after year, and you have the same identity year after year after year, and you don't let it change, it can become a kind of rigid box that you're in, even if it's wonderful. And maybe you're losing the opportunity to really be awake. So, And when we do continue doing the same thing, that's wonderful, and then we have jobs, families, responsibilities that continue the same, and we keep those, that's good too. But how do we, then you still have the question of how do you stay awake and fresh in that life? So retirement provides a particular opportunity. And I don't like the word retirement because it sounds it sounds like a has been. Oh, she's retired. Oh, she's not doing anything anymore, huh? I mean, what does it mean to stop doing one thing and then you take up something else? So I'm not retired in the sense of just being on the margins, and yet I am on the margins of what I was doing before, and as we get older, all of us, I think we move over to the sidelines more of what's really turning the wheels of the society, and that's another part of getting old and of letting go of jobs and identities that we had that is a challenge. So, and for me, if a brick fell on my head, there wouldn't be any important social event that couldn't happen. I mean, some writing workshops would have to get canceled, but you know, somebody else is editing a magazine. It's not as if the society would come to a halt anymore, and it wouldn't exactly have come to a halt if I was still editing Turning Wheel, but still I felt, you know, that I was a part of the ongoing work in the social world. So that's a big change, and it's also a big opportunity. So let me see what else here. Thinking about how we can contribute, whatever age we are and whatever kind of work we're doing, there are ways that we each can be making a contribution. And I've been thinking, what is it now to be an older person? And one can be mentoring, and one can be encouraging, and one can also just be modeling being an old person, continuing to function and live your life with some equanimity and continuing to practice. And I talked with Blanche Hartman, who's some of you might know her. She's a Zen teacher at San Francisco Zen Center, and she's one of the senior teachers there. She's a wonderful person. She's been active politically as well, and she's in her 80s, and her husband Lou Hartman is in his early 90s, and they live at City Center, and they've been practicing there for probably 50 years. And they both just keep on practicing. And I was talking to Blanche and asking her about aging and saying, well, how do you work with this? I really admire you. And she said she just feels that it is important to keep on practicing, to keep on showing up, to keep on being there, and that she tells herself what her teacher, Suzuki Roshi, told her many years ago, just as a general principle, just make your best effort in every moment. So whatever age you are, you can make your best effort in every moment. And I find that a really helpful thought. And if you're old and lame, making your best effort looks different, maybe. The position that you sit in looks different, or what work you can do in the Zen Center looks different, but it's still the same wholehearted effort. And if it's wholehearted and if it's your best effort, then you can't possibly be doing better than that. Lou, her husband, is quite frail physically, and he walks with a cane and very, very slowly, you know, takes half a step with each step, and it takes a long time to take each step. But he goes to Zazen, he follows the schedule, and it's just wonderful to have him there. and his spirits are good. So that's a huge accomplishment. I wanted to read you, or tell you a little quote from Yeats, who wrote a lot about old age and kind of raged against his own old age and how painful it was for him to get old and have regrets and not to have won the love of the woman of his heart and so on. But he writes wonderfully about it, and in one poem he says, this is from Sailing to Byzantium, he says, "An aged man is but a paltry thing, a tattered coat upon a stick, unless soul clap its hands and sing, and louder sing for every tatter in its mortal dress." So I think that too is a very mindful approach, where he's saying, yeah, I'm old, my mortal dress, this body, is really tattered, and I'm going to just celebrate it, and I'm going to be in it, and I'm going to say, right on, wrinkles, and here I am, I'm in it, and it's tattered. I mean, he's not making nice about it, but he's awake and accepting, and so we can all do that. Let our souls clap hands and sing for our own tatters, whatever they might be, to really accept where we are right now and not to turn away from it. When I was a child, I was thinking that I didn't have an identity the way adults do. Children don't. They don't have some job label, or they don't have to say, what is your sexual preference? Are you married? Are you divorced? Where do you work? You don't have to fill out all those things, and you don't have all those labels attached to you when you're a kid. You don't know who you are except who you are being that day as you're running around. And that we can kind of return a little bit to that spirit, perhaps. And when I was a child, I was a tomboy, and I was climbing trees all the time, and I was approaching the world with a lot of curiosity about, you know, what is this world, and how do I get up into this tree? And collecting stamps and starting clubs and having all kinds of curious activities and explorations in the world, and with no agenda at all. And I realized that I can still do that. I can't do it by climbing trees now, but I can bring that curiosity to the stage of life that I'm in now, and that I, again, don't have to be beholden to labels in the same way. And that when we're in the middle of our lives and creating our careers and work and finding what it is that we want to contribute, you do have a different kind of responsibility to finding out who you are in a social sense. But I think as we get older, there can be more of a return to just looking inward and asking, what does it mean to be sitting here and breathing the scent of these plum blossoms on this amazing spring day? I think that curiosity and that not knowing of childhood can be something to bring into our lives again. And children, you know, we ask children, or I don't know if people still do, but when I was a child, and I certainly have asked, what are you going to be when you grow up? And we're always asking that, what are you going to be when you grow up? And interestingly, the question is not what are you going to do when you grow up, it's what are you going to be when you grow up, as if it is a definition. You are attached to these kinds of definitions, and to break away from them is hard work. And children aren't so interested necessarily in that question. I mean, they may have answers, but they're not really worrying about it over much when they're really little, I don't think. And I was also remembering my own grandmother when I was a child, who I loved very dearly and was close to. And when I was realizing that when I was little, I didn't know that old was bad and young was good. Nobody had taught me that. Here was this wonderful person I loved. She was definitely old, but that was who she was. You know, it was just as good as anything else. And she walked with a cane, and she was pretty lame. But she used to, when I visited her, I used to get into bed with her in the morning, and she would open up her arms, and she'd invite me to come and snuggle up in bed with her. And she had this, wore this black sleep mask that I thought was the weirdest thing. It made her look like the Lone Ranger or something. And she would take off her sleep mask and welcome me into her bed. And I remember her, the flesh on her upper arms that sort of hung down, and it was very pendulous and soft and smooth. And I just thought it was so wonderful. I loved it. It was so cool. And I just think, isn't that great that a child would think that was so wonderful? And now, you know, it's a horror. Oh my God, isn't that wonderful? So now I have a granddaughter, so I can go like this to my I haven't quite achieved my grandmother's level of nice, soft flesh, but I'm working on it. That's the main thing I wanted to bring before you, and I have a couple of quotes that I just pulled off the internet that I thought I'd share with you too for fun. This friend sent me some comments about senility or something, or aging. So here's a little joke. One woman says, "I feel like my body has gotten totally out of shape, so I got my doctor's permission to join a fitness club and start exercising. I decided to take an aerobics class for seniors. I bent, twisted, gyrated, jumped up and down, and perspired for an hour. But by the time I got my leotard on, the class was over." So now here's a Chinese proverb says, "Men grow old, pearls grow yellow, there is no cure for it." Plato said, "The spiritual eyesight improves as the physical eyesight declines." Somebody named San Banducci, and I don't know who that is, said, "Old age comes at a bad time." Leon Trotsky said, "Old age is the most unexpected of all the things that happen to a man." That's really true, I think. That's what's so surprising. Wait, this wasn't supposed to happen to me! We kind of have the idea that, you know, if we just really keep exercising and keep taking our vitamins and listen really hard, we won't. It's like it's your fault if you get deaf and lame. And if you're young, you kind of forget that it isn't really the fault of old people when they get old. So, you might as well expect it. Edith Wharton said, "In spite of illness, in spite even of the arch enemy of sorrow, one can remain alive long past the usual date of disintegration if one is unafraid of change, insatiable in intellectual curiosity, interested in big things, and happy in a small way." And maybe I'll just end with this one. Adolf Zukor, I also don't know who that is, on approaching his 100th birthday, said, "If I'd known how old I was going to be, I'd have taken better care of myself." So, let's have some discussion. We have some time to talk.
Yes. I'd like to make two comments. One is, there was a period of time when I did dye my hair, not for a very long time, and it was very interesting how people responded to me and how people respond to me now that I have gray hair. And I just came to the conclusion that, you know, it wasn't worth it. I really wanted to just be who I am. And then the other thing is, a gay man who does not have children or biological children, One of the things that I'm concerned about as I get old, unlike my parents and my grandparents, they had an extended family. Mm-hmm. And when my parents were dying, you know, my siblings and I sort of figured out how to deal with that. And I have a community of friends, but I guess in my mind, the way I think I'm going to be able to handle that is, I guess I'm going to have to save money to hire someone to take care of me, or to at least, you know, make me transition from that point of where maybe I'm disabled and I'm dying and I want to die in my house rather than in a nursing home. And so I kind of envy my parents that they had that opportunity, mm-hmm. and I don't think necessarily that I will. Mm-hmm. I don't know how other gay men feel about that, but it's something I don't mind so much getting old. In fact, I look forward to it. I would feel cheated if I got hit by a bus or had some mental illness, but I like the idea of being 85 and trying to mm-hmm. ride my bicycle. And, mm-hmm. I do think as I get older, I become more marginalized, and in some ways, I identify with my job more. Mm-hmm. You know, it gives me some kind of mm-hmm. a compass.
Well, I think that's a very real concern, what you're bringing up, and I understand what you're saying about not having family generations following you who could be taking care of you, and you know, that's a concern for others as well as gay men, but I'm single, so I don't have a partner. And I do have children, but they're far away. And then there are people who have children and families, but their families send them off to a nursing home, don't want to take care of them. So, I mean, there's no guarantees, but you do definitely know already that this is something that you want to think about and prepare for. And again, it brings us back to the importance of our communities of friendship that we are creating for ourselves all the time when we're younger, too, which is all preparation. Getting older, that we're always creating our families in a way, the real life families that we live among. And then the idea of saving, it's expensive to be old too. That's another difficulty which our healthcare system isn't helping us with very much, but those are definitely real concerns. Yes.
I love the story of the Buddha leaving his palace because I think it's so pertinent to our own times. Mm-hmm. We're that Buddha too, and we're pampered by our culture and protected from old age, mm-hmm. death, and sickness. We've got Botox and plastic surgery and movies and TV that show us that everybody is young and beautiful. In so many ways, we live inside that palace in a contemporary culture, and I think we're dealing with exactly the same issues. And to have to make an extra effort, as Buddha did, to see the reality behind all that illusion.
So thank you for saying that. That's so true. Yeah, we have a responsibility to know what's outside the palace. Yeah. Yes.
You know, kind of a humorous thing that I'm 63 and I knew I was getting old like about 3 years ago. People started calling me sir. Uh-huh. My name's Paul. I'm not a sir. You know?
Yeah.
One thing
yeah. And how did that feel to you?
Well, it felt bad.
Well, that's what I meant.
I crossed that line and now, but on the other hand, it was like, why don't people show that kind of respect down the line, mm-hmm. you know? Actually, I kind of liked it because there's a part of me that liked it because it came from a place of reverence that I was old, mm-hmm. you know? And I liked that. And in a way, I didn't experience that until I got there, mm-hmm. you know? I didn't expect the same reverence as a person in day-to-day contact, mm-hmm. you know? But the gray hair that I occasionally dye, you know, has gotten me a sir. And mm-hmm. so there's,
yeah.
if I focus on the good things about that, yeah. it's really nice. And I have a hard time acknowledging the wisdom in me as I get old. But when I do, it's quite precious, mm-hmm. you know, and quite... it's quite wonderful. Everything that I've done has brought me to this moment, and I
and I've done a lot. Mm-hmm. So that kind of feels good. The other stuff you said about the body, I already had one knee replacement, and it's tough. Mm-hmm. You know, it really is tough. But I like your invitation, you know, to focus on the humor and to focus on what aches it does bring, you know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I always had a yearning, you know, to teach, and in my own way I've started that. And that feels good too.
That's great. That's so age appropriate. I mean, really, it is wonderful to be able to find some respect for elders, and you know, we like the idea of respect for elders, but we don't think that means us. But yes, we can respect ourselves as elders, and as you say, to have confidence and to trust what you have learned in this life, and we've all learned so much, and that there's a lot of knowledge and a lot of wisdom in there from the experiences that we've had. Yes.
I just think it's interesting in American culture there's so much age segregation, and, mm-hmm. and most people just, you know, are only with people who are close to them in mm-hmm. age, and I think increasingly there's less extended families and people are less used to being around old people or being around children. And I think particularly as you know, queer people, not that many of us are around kids, and you know, some of us don't even want to be around kids, and I definitely miss that. I wish I had more older people in my life, and then I had more younger people in my life. I think on the other hand, though, you know, being in some gay community groups, I had access to more, you know, of a range of ages, where, you know, my straight friends, when we were in our 20s, like, everyone they was around was in their 20s, and I was going to gatherings where I would see men, you know, who were in their 30s and 40s and 50s and 60s, and I found that very comforting, you know, especially as a queer, to be able to see, like, oh, well, that's how I could live my life, or, oh, that's what might happen to me, you know, whereas I think some of my straight friends just didn't have any sense of that, you know, and everything was about, you know, being 21 and partying and not having access to that. And I also think it's interesting in, you know, in English and in the U.S., we don't, like, in a lot of cultures, you know, in Russian, you say babushka, which means grandmother, and it's something that you just sit, you know, if you're waiting on an old woman, you know, when you're working retail, it's a way of saying, you know, honored grandmother, and most cultures have that kind of concept, and we don't. Mm-hmm. And we've also kind of abandoned just the things like saying ma'am and sir. Like, you know, even though I'm only 41, you know, I passed that other little hump, and now, you know, teenagers, when they wait on me, will occasionally call me sir, which they didn't, you know, a couple of years ago. But I think we noticed that because, you know, 20 years ago, a lot of people said ma'am and sir. And now it's much less common, and so it's a little more striking when you hear it.
Yeah. And diversity of age is important to have, as you say. It actually looks like you're a Sangha. You're doing pretty well here. Pretty good spread growing. Yes.
Yeah, I did a workshop a couple months ago on aging with about 25 gay men mm-hmm. in Berkeley. And one of the things that came up sort of contradicted exactly what you were saying, is that in gay culture, you're young and then you're old. Mm-hmm. There's no adult stage, and we lose the roles of being elderly.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, as we get older in gay culture, we're kind of pushed off to the side. Mm-hmm. We don't have opportunities to be wise and to help mm-hmm. younger gay mm-hmm. people. That role doesn't seem to exist very much. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of a pity. I mean, it's, you know, older gay men have a lot to offer to younger gay men, but we don't. I don't think we really have that kind of culture mm-hmm. That we're permitted or we're asked to share our wisdom. You know? Yeah.
Maybe there are ways that groups like this or the workshop you went to are finding ways that you can make those offerings to older men, to offer something to younger men. Because there certainly must be lots of channels, though, places of need, too. But I don't know if it's hard to connect with them. Yes, Jim.
I recently spent a dinner with, also with my aunt, and she and my mother share the same very strong sense that they're done.
Really?
they've completed their arc. Mm-hmm. As my aunt very poetically says, you know, there should be a stepping off point that society honors, you mm-hmm. know, for people who have lived their lives and don't use up any more resources and are complete. Mm-hmm. And I was just very moved by her mm-hmm. clarity, and that they're both just ready to die, and they don't really know why they're still here. They're not unengaged, they're not loved, unloved, they're not yeah. uncared for. They're just done.
Yeah.
And I didn't feel very resourceful in responding to yeah. her. She says, I don't have the courage to kill myself.
How old is she?
She'll be 90.
Uh-huh. Pretty old.
Pretty old, yeah.
Apparently the Eskimos put old people out in an ice floe and say bye.
That's exactly what
yeah.
she's thinking.
And everybody knows that, and yeah. old people are ready to go on the ice floe. They don't object. They get along. And there is a sense of, I mean, the question about using resources is an interesting question.
Yeah,
but of course this, I mean, our culture isn't one that knows where to put its resources, so. I'd a lot rather use our resources to keep your aunt and mother going strong than what we are using them for, so. But yes.
It seems that, thank you very much for your talk, I really appreciate it. It seems that perhaps the engaged Buddhism is something that's really calling us, you know, as the gentleman was talking about before, to look creatively at some of those things.
So. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I hope you'll continue to share ideas with each other about how to do that too. I guess this is a good forum for it. Yes.
Yeah. This is kind of a segue to what Jim said, but I work as a clinical director in a facility for people with Alzheimer's and dementia.
Uh-huh.
And you know, people are placed there because their cognitive functions are leaving mm-hmm. and disappearing mm-hmm. slowly. And this week I was having a talk with the interns, and the fairly new interns working in this facility, and they were, one intern just said right out, she said, I'd rather kill myself than live in this place.
Wow.
And yeah, it was a very strong statement. Mm-hmm. And I think I was really struck with it's the suffering of taking one's life versus the suffering of mm-hmm. living in this place.
Mm-hmm. What did you say to her when she said that?
I just kind of like helped her reflect on yeah. that some more, yeah. and we talked about it as a group. And,
yeah.
And I stated eventually that I think I've come to a place, and I don't know if it's a better place or not, but I've come to a place where I would not take my life,
uh-huh.
and I would allow myself to be taken care of.
Yeah.
Because people are taken care of.
Well, that's another change in identity, too, that comes with aging. This
yeah.
way short of Alzheimer's is just to let people take care of you. But people who are used to being proud and independent and powerful, it's hard to ask for help. But then with Alzheimer's, it's not as if you have the choice at a certain point. Oh, I think I don't like this anymore. I think I'll kill myself. I mean, a lot of Alzheimer's patients would not be able to do such a thing. So you have to make that, and you think, oh, it's coming down the road. I better kill myself first. Or, I mean, it's, you know, you don't really get those choices necessarily offered to you. Hmm. Yes.
I'm very struck by the issue of older people and younger people in the gay community.
Mm-hmm.
Because I do think that relationships and connections in that way are very much lacking, and I think it's a loss, and I think our community could be much richer
mm-hmm.
If we had more of it. And I think that two emotions that come into play that I think keep that from happening more are issues of fear and issues of trust.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that I think older men have issues about the fear of being rejected by younger men that they might want to help nurture. I think we have fear of how others might look at us
mm-hmm.
in terms of offering or having an interest mm-hmm. in being nurturing that way. I think that we have fear within ourselves at times as to maybe exactly what we're up to, mm-hmm. or taking other people's projections onto
mm-hmm.
us.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think that, and that's where I think the trust piece has
yeah.
come in, that I think we need to get clear on some of this ourselves and then develop with that clarity, develop
mm-hmm.
a capacity to trust ourselves
yeah.
and our intentions.
That's good. Thank you. Well, I mean, it's an ongoing conversation, I think. And I think at this point it has to be an ongoing conversation because I see it's all getting close to noon. So maybe we can continue talking. I'll be here for a little bit, and I'm happy to talk with you some more. And I hope you talk with each other, too, about just this how to support each other across age differences. So thank you very much.
We have time now for a few announcements. Do we have a host this morning?
I'm the host today. There's apples and some carrot cake that's sweetened with honey, but it's not vegan. If you have tea, please wash out your cup and put it away on a rack to dry. I'm going to be coming up with the Donna Bowl. The suggested donation is $5 to $8, but there's no requirement for that. There's a sign-up sheet, so if you're new members and you're visiting us and you want to keep in touch with the sign-up, please sign up on there. And there's also that same sign-up that's used for the GBF directory. If anyone here hasn't signed up and would like to, please put your name on there and indicate whether you'd like to actually be in the directory or not. And at the end of the social time, people are going to sort of gather for the door who plan on going out for lunch later, so if you'd like to join them.
Any other announcements? Michael?
Yeah, my name is Michael Murphy, and I'm the coordinator of the annual GBF retreat, and the dates have been set for this year. It's going to be September 19th through the 21st at Vajrapani Institute. So save those dates, and I'll be making further announcements in weeks to come.
Susan?
I had an announcement about a writing workshop I'll be teaching. I put some flyers out next to the Donna Bowl. It's a weekend workshop in Southern California at a Buddhist retreat center called Manzanita Village, which is a wonderful place. Teaching there with Adriana Reed. So pick up a flyer if you're interested or know somebody else who might be. It's a really great place.
Yeah.
A couple of months ago, the AIDS Health Project, which is on Market Street, I'm sure most of you know about it, had a one-night seminar on gays and aging. And it was really interesting. They had a guy in his 70s, one in his 60s, one in his 50s, 40s, 30s, and a 23-year-old guy. And they were asked the same questions. And it generated so much interest that night that they are now starting, this month, starting a workshop on gays and aging, ongoing support group, I guess they're calling it. So if you're interested, you can get in touch with the AIDS Health Project on Market Street.
Yes.
I have two announcements. The speaker for next week is Lynn Maslow, and some of you may know him. Before he moved up to Marin, he was a member of the Sangha. He was ordained in 2006 by Chakuta Lewis Richmond. He follows the Zen tradition. He spent a lot of 2007 living at Green Gulch. And then the second announcement is that usually every 4 to 6 weeks we try and read letters that we get from gay prisoners with our prison outreach project. And today we're going to be reading letters, and it would be very good practice and compassion for several people to sit with us. We meet at 12:20 and read letters, and we try and respond to the requests that come in. So if you have time, we'll just be sitting on the couch out there, and if you can stay for 15 or 20 minutes, that would be great.
If there are no other announcements, if we could gather in a circle, Susan will pronounce with a dedication prayer.
We dedicate the merit of our practice to all beings, and in particularly today, we dedicate the merit to all those who are suffering from the infirmities and disabilities and losses of age. We send them and ourselves wishes for courage and equanimity and for feeling the support and love of friends, family, community, and all the Buddhas and ancestors. And we may we all together, for as long as we are alive, share with each other our gratitude for the precious gift of human birth.
Thank you for listening to the Gay Buddhist Forum. If you would like to hear several new talks per month and be notified of upcoming speakers so you can participate live, please subscribe to this podcast, like us on Facebook, and join our mailing list by visiting gaybuddhist.org.